Intro. This next story begins in the valleys between the hills in West Virginia, in a place they call the Holler, where a young girl named Melissa McFadden lived in a trailer with her mother and her three sisters.
Well, Price Hill is a one street, and it dead ends into a mountain and woods. So when you come up, it's a long, winding road, and you got to cross a little bridge, and you get to where I lived. I lived in a trailer, and we had an uncle that would come over and to our trailer when my mother was gone to grocery store or wherever. He would come there, and he would always try to fight us, and he's real strong and big, and he would try to beat us up often. But Mom said she don't expect us, if somebody's messing with us or hitting us, she expects us to fight.
It was the last thing her mom would say before she'd leave them alone for the day, every time.
She always told us, you know, you don't start trouble, but if it comes to you, you better handle it.
What does that mean?
That means that don't back down from anyone. Stand there and stand up for yourself.
Because she grew up in the Holler, there wasn't anyone around to protect them. They had to protect themselves. So Melissa began to idolize police officers. Even though there weren't any police officers where she lived, she knew about them, and she was enamored with the idea of them.
I just know police officers have a duty to protect the poor, to protect the downtrodden. Because I felt as a poor person, I felt I was mistreated based on my poverty. So at 14, that's when I just decided what I wanted to do with my life.
So from then on, she had this singular goal of becoming a police officer.
I've been preparing for this since I was 14. So no drinking, no drugs, I didn't do anything that would ruin my chances. I didn't want to put myself at risk for not being able to get the job that I wanted.
So right out of high school, she entered the Army. And when she got out of the Army, her mom had moved to Columbus, Ohio, and she became a security officer there. And when she was ready, she took the entrance exam and was admitted as a cadet into the police academy.
I was so happy to be there. I was so bright-eyed and like, I love being the police. We are family. Oh, my God. It was just such a great honor. And to finally get that badge on my chest, like, oh, look at me. I'm the police now. I'm looking like a brand new officer and just so happy to be there. And they teach you in there that you're family and that we stick together and we're brothers. We're brothers and sisters in blue. I believed it. I felt that I was welcomed, that, hey, I'm blue. We're all blue. So it was fun. It's fun to go to work. You get to go see all these different things that's going on that you've never seen before, you never experienced before.
She was actually getting to do the work she wanted to do as a kid. One of the most meaningful parts of the work, actually, was when she would get called to a DOA.
We call them DOAs, death on arrival, dead on arrival, 1018s we call them. So we have to show up to people's houses when their loved one has passed away and take care of having the body removed and calling a funeral home and things like that for these people. It never leaves you. And so there was one I went on specifically.
There was one call McFadden went to, and when she arrived on scene, a young single mother had passed away, and her toddler was still in the house.
Upstairs was her 2-year-old baby in the crib. She had been there for a couple of days. So if we hadn't showed up when we did, who knows what would have happened to that baby. So we were able to get the baby, get her, the lady taken care of, getting her out of there, and, you know, helping that family.
But helping babies and caring for survivors, she would soon learn, was the easy part of the job. It got more complicated, quickly. One day, during her training, she and her partner were patrolling the streets of Columbus, and they drove by another officer, Officer Dave, who was doing a routine traffic stop. And in that traffic stop, they saw that he was illegally searching a car. McFadden said it just scared her, like it was the kind of policing she didn't want to be a part of, and she didn't know what to do about it. She just knew she worried about being paired with Officer Dave because what she saw made her nervous. And then, of course, a few days later at roll call, the sergeant told her she'd be riding with Officer Dave that day.
So I basically spoke up at roll call and told the sergeant that I do not want to ride with Dave. And they asked me why, and I said, because Dave searches cars illegally. He's like, no, I don't. Dave was like, no, I don't. I said, yes, you do. I saw you. I saw you.
You're just saying this in the middle of roll call.
Right. In front of him, the sergeant, all the other officers. Because I was so scared to work with him. Because I did not want to be involved in any legal violation of people's rights. I didn't want to be involved in that. I was concerned that I would be on Crooked Cops of Columbus. That was terrifying to me. I did not want to be a part of that.
Everybody was standing there watching when she just blurted out this accusation against another officer.
I even say to myself, what was I thinking? Like right now. But as my young me, I've always called out what's right because I am a rule follower. Well, when I spoke up, I did not realize that it was a thin blue line like it is. I didn't realize that blue line existed. I realized we were family. But even in my family, when I did wrong, my mom told me I did that. But little did I know that I was not supposed to speak on that. And I found that out when days later, I got a call.
The call was from her field training officer, the officer who determined if she would continue to advance or if she would be denied advancement and therefore likely cut from the force. He said someone had reported concerns about her safety in the field.
He said that because I stood in front of a door when we knocked for a person that said somebody was in her house, which is not true. We're trained to stand on the side of the doors. So I knew then, you're trying to send me a phase three on one incident? I knew immediately it was retaliation. And that's after that same night, I, at roll call, told Dave about illegal searches. So I knew that was something up. I was so outdone. And at that moment, at that very moment, it just opened my eyes. It's like I had covers on my eyes. And when that I heard that and saw that, it all just lifted from my eyes. The covers just was totally off.
Is it fair to say that then you became known for calling out unprofessional conduct?
Yes, and that I will actually tell on anybody if they're going to mistreat people, if they're going to break rules. At that point in my career, I believe I was labeled as not wanting to, I guess, be a part of the family.
They investigated the claims against her and found them to be unfounded. So McFadden moved forward. Her first position was as a patrol officer. Then she got her associate's degree and landed a position in the advanced training department. She was excited to help lead workshops and run classes, and other folks from her rookie class were in that department with her. But she was noticing a change in their behavior towards her.
Like, just not going to lunch with me, sending me emails saying that they don't have to socialize with me.
So she would eat alone at her desk. There was one time she was invited to go along with the others.
So this one particular day, they go out to lunch and they ask me if I don't want to go. I said, yeah, I want to go. So I go out to the car. So there's the driver, the passenger, and they got two people in the back seat. So I go out to the car and I put my hand on the car door to go with them to lunch to open it. They drive off and leave me in the parking lot. So I'm thinking maybe they're joking. As they drive out the parking lot and turn right onto the street and then go to the light and turn right on the other street, they never came back to get me. They left me in the parking lot. It was hurtful, but it made me angry. I just couldn't believe he just did that. This is a person that's out of my academy class. And he would do this to me in front of all these people. It was embarrassing.
McFadden was the only woman in the department at that time.
And then one day I came in and there was a dummy, like a styrofoam, like foam dummy with a bra on it, sitting in one of the chairs in the office.
Being left out and taunted, McFadden noticed that her supervisor also was excluding her from work activities.
So I noticed when he would come in and give out the lesson plans for review, he wouldn't give me one. Sometimes I would come in and they're all in their meeting and didn't know anything about the meetings. So I'm like, this is crazy. And mind you, at the time, I was the only one in the room with the degree. The only one in the room with the degree. So it was very hurtful being in that position and feeling that separation, that racism, being the only female and black in that area at the time. So it was very disturbing. And right now, like even now thinking about it, it brings up just very bad feelings.
Not only had she called people out, but she was a young, educated black woman calling people out. Driving to work each day, Melissa would pray.
It was so hard to come into work. A lot of times I would pray that, Lord, don't let anything happen today that would make me feel inept or make me feel less than. It was a very dark time for me because this is my first true experience with racism in my face. I started to feel that maybe I am inferior to everybody else in the room. Maybe I am not worthy. Maybe I can't do the job like everybody else. When I would drive in the thing, drive into work, I would feel so just inferior. And wonder how I'm going to get treated today. I wouldn't want to get out of my car.
She tried talking to her coworkers. She tried filing official complaints. She tried going to the Equal Opportunity Board and to the Ohio Civil Rights Commission, but nothing seemed to change the culture. She wasn't sure what she could do, because she was told in the beginning, in no uncertain terms, that no one was allowed to speak out against the department.
You can't speak out. They have a rule in our book that says you cannot speak out against a division employee.
So she decided to do two things. First, do her job well. Be someone the community trusted. And that came naturally to her.
Like, we had two shootings near elementary school, and somebody called me and said, hey, can you get police protection? I like doing that. I had another person call me. His sister got murdered, and he had a tip. Who did it? He don't want to tell anybody else, but he tells me because he trusts me. So that kind of community building, I'm a watcher for the community.
Second, in the time when she wasn't doing the work of policing, she decided to become so well-educated that she was bulletproof.
I said, enough. I said, not only am I going to get as many degrees as I can, because they pay for it, but I'm going to get the best degrees. So I felt, if I got these degrees, how can they say I'm not as good as everybody else?
She got a bachelor's in criminology, and then another bachelor's in social work, and then a master's in criminal justice. She was promoted to sergeant, and then lieutenant. And she also found out through the course of her studying that she was not alone. She came across this testimony of a man named Richard Lay. He had been an officer with the Columbus Division of Police, and he testified about a time he was dispatched to a call.
And he responded. And when he responded, it was an empty field, and it was a bunch of males in white clothing and hoods. And they were his coworkers, and they were actually in KKK outfits, and it was actually people he worked with.
When McFadden learned about Officer Lay and his testimony, she knew immediately she wanted to go and meet him and talk to him. He was pretty old by that point.
I actually went to the hospital to see him when he was in a rehabilitation home, and I met his family.
He was unwell when she got there, so she talked to his family and held his hand and thanked him. And the weight of the history of the division pressed on her.
Well, because I'm from West Virginia and I came here after I got out the military, I wasn't familiar with the history. I didn't know about the racism. I wasn't aware of it. In the 1970s, black officers were not allowed to work with white officers. They were only allowed to work in certain assignments like burglary, certain black neighborhoods in the community on patrol. They weren't even allowed to work in the same wagon, like paddy wagon, with the officer, a white officer.
She learned that in 1978, a group of black officers from the Columbus Police Division started to file for a class action lawsuit and eventually testified for hundreds of hours with disturbing accounts of racism in the division. One black officer testified that two white officers presented her with a bunch of bananas. Others said the N-word was used unhesitatingly by officers and it was scrawled on desks and walls and bathroom stalls. And one issue that would come up across so many testimonies is that they were not able to advance. McFadden says she was disturbed, but also motivated to stay with the division.
So it stems from the people before me, the African Americans before me, because there were some of the people still here at the time. And I felt like if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here. So I move forward because it's like I feel comfortable in this fight.
And then she went to law school, started working on a law degree.
That's when I started monitoring what the division was doing. I would get to know my rules very well so I can see when they're not doing the things they're supposed to do right.
She advanced to the rank of lieutenant. McFadden worked with the division for 20 years.
People would come to me about EEO issues they would have. So behind the scenes, I would counsel people on what they could do about it, what they need to do about it, how they would go about making sure they have the evidence they needed. Because they knew that I'm not a part of the cover-up culture, so it is. Sometimes they call me. Sometimes they'll show up and meet me somewhere.
On March 27th, 2017, McFadden got a message from a young black woman on the force she knew. It said, "I can't take it anymore." So McFadden and this officer arranged to meet together in a library. The young woman said she had filed a grievance against her superior, and she felt like she might be facing some retaliation for it. And she wanted advice. So McFadden helped her to escalate her complaint. And it angered a lot of people. A lot of high-ranking people. Melissa was sitting in on meetings and writing letters on behalf of this young woman.
That's a problem. When you call people out on things that they're not doing right, they want to seek revenge and retaliation. So I came in. And where I worked at was on patrol, and I worked in a substation on the east side. I walked in like I normally do, and I went downstairs. So when I'm sitting down getting ready to put my stuff down, they came downstairs, and she says, the commander at the time, "You're being relieved of duty, relieved of assignment. You're being relieved of assignment." So I just smiled like, okay, this is kind of weird.
McFadden was informed that she was going to be investigated, that her fellow officers had filed a complaint against her. She was accused of creating a hostile work environment and of having a black militant mindset, among other things.
And she said, okay, tomorrow you'll report to the property room. I was upset, very upset. And confused, nervous, not understanding what it was for, because I hadn't done anything wrong.
She was told that it would take some time to investigate the complaint against her, and that in the meantime, she should report to the property room.
And I'm sitting there. They have me doing bulletproof vest panels, ripping them out of the covers, stacking them up. They were molded, mildewed. They smelled bad, had bugs in there. They'd been there for years, since the early 90s. And when I go out to the crates, these big crates where all the old bulletproof vests were in, I would have to use a ladder, and I would be down in the crates trying to get them out. I would pull them out, and I would put them in a shopping cart that we had there so I can push them to the office to work on them. While I'm there, officers would come by me and be like, "How's your day today?" And asking, you know, saying hello. But in reality, they're looking at a lieutenant pushing a shopping cart. And it was so humiliating when they have officers that have been accused of soliciting in prostitution, different things like that, not doing any physical labor. That's what you have a lieutenant that's making $130,000 a year to do. And so I would pretend when they would walk past me while I'm in those bins pulling out those vests, I would say good morning just like they would say to me. Or if they didn't speak, I'd still speak. I always tried to keep a smile on my face. But as soon as I got home or in my car, it would be a different story. There's often times I would cry. Many nights I couldn't sleep. So it's hard. It's hard for me to express my emotions because I'm so used to trying to keep them contained.
Eventually, she was asked to hand over her gun and her badge.
Do you know how significant that is to an officer? It's very significant, especially when you're an officer. Taking your badge and gun is like serious, critical. I had to go to counseling because I just could not. I wanted to find coping mechanisms because I've never dealt with this type of racism, this structured racism. It was, I would say I was depressed and very worried at times. That's when I was just, how can you win in a system like that when it's the fix is in the beginning?
She said she'd never felt more isolated. She was getting no information at all about the investigation. But then one day she was home with the TV on.
And I see myself on the news, my picture, and they're talking about the investigation.
Internal Affairs investigation could lead to further discipline for a Columbus police lieutenant who could lose her badge.
Here's what I can tell you. Lieutenant Melissa McFadden has been relieved of her assignment. Chief Kim Jacobs recommending she be disciplined further, possibly fired.
And I'm just like, oh, my God. They released it to the news media. And I'm just like, what chance do I have? I felt like I was hopeless in a sense because I didn't have anyone that had authority to turn to. So at that point, when it came out on the news, I just prayed and I asked God. I said, look what they're doing, God.
And at that moment, I said, it's time for me to stand up.
Because they've always had a rule to say you can't speak out. They have a rule in our book that says you cannot speak out against the division, against a division employee. But me and in law school, I found that that's not true. So that rule has been in place for years, since I've been on it before me. And if you talk to other police officers in the past, they won't speak about the division because that's been the rule. But once they put me on the news and I knew the law, that's when I started speaking out.
She went to the photocopy shop and printed out 8x10 cards listing all of the misconduct she had witnessed over the years.
I passed out hot cards, letting them know the division is broken because the people in the community know my character. And even the people in the community didn't know. They knew something was weird about it. Like, really? All the racist stuff that goes on all the time, you don't put anybody else on the news and you're putting her on the news.
I was getting phone calls. I was getting other officers were sending me cards and stuff for people that want to reach out to me.
Someone recommended that she reach out to a pastor. And that pastor connected her to another pastor who connected her to another pastor until she got an idea. She would hold her own truth commission. She convinced a handful of officers who had confided in her with similar complaints to meet with a council of pastors in a church.
I worried about the other officers being at risk because the retaliation is fierce here. Remember that it was a little room in this church that we were at, and the pastors were like, maybe 8 to 10 of them, the pastors showed up.
But when McFadden arrived that morning, none of the other officers were there. Were you scared they wouldn't show up?
Yes, of course, because of the fear of retaliation is very strong. And self-preservation would kick in by the time they get in their car to drive that way. And then they showed up as it trickled in. I was just so happy to see them coming to help me, even though it's behind the scenes.
Is there a recording?
As a matter of fact, one of the pastors wanted to record the tape us, and we wouldn't allow it because they were scared to be seen, you know, speaking, telling their story. We were each telling our story to these pastors, letting them know how black officers are treated differently or we're disciplined much harshly than non-minority officers. And female officers are too, we told them.
McFadden and the pastors made a plan to go to City Hall to demand the police division be held accountable to its black officers. Did you worry this would make them more mad?
Of course, yes. Definitely would make them more mad. Not only them, but even the people that aren't mad at me. Because I am basically telling what's going on in-house, I'm airing our dirty laundry, my job was definitely on the table there for sure. I had no other options. They had already went public with it. I would have never went public unless if they had not went public.
On July 16th, 2018, McFadden and the other pastors stood up before the Columbus City Council.
I was very, very nervous, and you only had like 3 minutes.
And so I had written my little speech, and I just read my speech, how we as Black officers have to battle racism internally. And it's hard for us to protect the Black community, trying to protect them. We got to protect ourselves.
A woman named Jody Ann Howell stood up before the council. She said normally she addresses city council regarding police brutality and other issues. But today, she was there to speak for Lieutenant McFadden. When a man named Donald Muhammad spoke on behalf of McFadden, there was so much applause in the council chambers that they had to call for order. Pastor Michael Reeves stood up, and he told the story about how in 1989, a police officer told the truth about an officer-involved shooting of a young Black boy, and when he did, his life became hell. He said this was deja vu. After the city council event, things took off.
And when I tell you that I got calls from people I did not know that said, we want to help you, I was popping up everywhere. There was billboards put up talking about corruption of the division of police and how they treat females and minorities.
One billboard put up by the League of Black Women Voters said, support Melissa McFadden. Call the mayor.
It was just, no one goes against the division. No one would dare to put up a billboard about the corruption going on in the division. It was just an awesome feeling. It was an awesome feeling. It's like, to me, in my head, I was like, you want to put me on the news? You want this public battle? Here you go. Here's your public battle. It was at this real popular area called Main and Nelson. A lot of cars. And one time I went to see it, and I was sitting across the street looking at it, and I saw the commander at the time drive by the billboard and stop in her city car. What's the chances of that? That's the same commander that relieved me of assignment, same one that took my badge and gun. She drove by the billboard and she stopped and looked at the billboard. And it made me feel strong. I felt like I was David and I had the little slingshot. It was my slingshot. But at home, it was quietness because you don't know what's going on with the investigation. I was sitting at home wondering, like, when is this going to be over? Why this is happening to me?
Did anyone in your family ever say, hey, just walk away?
My father-in-law lives in Arizona. And he retired sergeant from the division of police. I called him and was telling him what was going on. He specifically told me, you can't beat the division. You cannot beat the division. Many have tried. You can't beat the division. And I was like, seriously? Why would you say that? I guess because it's never really been done. It just scared me because if my father-in-law had been there for 30, 25 plus years, and he's telling me I can't beat the division, and for him to tell me that, I had doubts about my ability. I just remember those words. They resonate with me even to this day. You can't beat the division.
Melissa waited at home to hear the results of the investigation against her, to hear the results of the recommendation that she be terminated.
I was at my house. I was at home, and my husband was there, and my mom was there because she lived with me at the time. And I got a call from the union lawyer, and she told me, hey, the safety...
They asked her to make a choice. They said she could name her own discipline or leave it in the hands of the investigation and possibly still be fired.
I was nervous. I was just panicked because it was a decision I need to make right then. My heart starts beating real fast and I get this feeling of just uneasiness all over my body. It's like a shock to my body in a sense. I was in the living room. I told her, hold on. And so I went in the bedroom and I told my husband. And I said, I need to make the decision now. And my husband, without hesitation, He said, well, then let them terminate you then. Because my husband knew I didn't do anything wrong.
So she put the phone back to her ear.
So I said, well, I'm not picking any discipline because I didn't do anything wrong. And if they can terminate me, let them terminate me. And she says, okay. And we hung up the phone.
It sounds equivalent to like not taking a plea bargain.
Correct.
Because you're not guilty.
Correct. I'm not taking a plea bargain. That's what they wanted.
Do you feel like being a cop is your whole identity? Was your identity on the line?
Well, I don't think it's been my identity. I would say it's been my calling since I was 14. The difference between me and an officer that their identity is a police officer is those type of officers are the ones that cover up stuff. They believe in the blue line. They believe that they are the authoritarian people of the earth. That's what they believe. That's in their bones. And that's why they cover up and come and attack people. I believe that I'm human. And this policing is a job that I do. Whereas when you have people that believe this is who they are, those are the people that end up killing unarmed black men. Those are the officers that end up punching people for no reason. Those are the officers that attack a female lieutenant for standing up for another black female officer.
So why not leave? Why be part of a corrupt system?
In order to change behaviors and change things, it's easier to do it if you're inside as opposed to being outside.
Around this time, the Columbus Division of Police had a higher rate of officer-involved killings than 99% of police departments in America. So McFadden waited for the result of the investigation against her. She waited for a total of 18 months, and then she got a phone call.
Yeah, I got the call, and I was listening to what they said, and then I got off the phone, and I was like, yes, and I was screaming and everything.
They told her she wasn't terminated. The discipline that she was given was nothing at all.
The safety director said, not sustained, no discipline at all, because I did not do anything wrong. And I just jumped and cried. And at the time, my mom lived with me. And she came in there like, what's going on? And I just told her, and she's like, she praised God. That's the most victorious part is when I won that, because they did so much to try to humiliate me. And that was my most proudest moment, because I just think, you went through all that for what? Now you're looking crazy.
Melissa got ready to finally go back to work. She got in her car, said her prayers again on her way in.
I kind of felt bad because if I look back, when I was real cocky driving back to work, I was cocky. I was like, now what, people? I beat you, now what? So in my head, I was thinking, and I was like, Melissa, you need to be humble. You need not be cocky like this. But I was very cocky when I drove back into work. So I remember that, and I remember going down stairs where I worked. I worked down in the basement. So I go down to my office, and there's this lieutenant there. And while I was gone, this lieutenant was at roll call, and he told one of the roll call people, these officers, that he can't wait until I'm fired. He's going to take my shit out and burn it. So my first day down back, I walk downstairs, and he's sitting at my desk. So I say to him, hey, when are you going to take my shit out and burn it? He's like, what? I said, didn't you say that you're going to take my shit out and burn it? He was like, well, no, I said I was going to take it to the property room. I said, oh, that's what you said? I said, okay, long, because I know you're not going to take my shit out and burn it. And that was it. And he's like, you want to go to lunch?
Did you go to lunch?
Yes, I went to lunch and I let it go.
McFadden sued the police division and she won. And she still goes to work there every day. Do you feel like you're behind enemy lines?
I do. Every day I put on my battle gear, my boots and everything in my mind, and I'm coming in for battle every day.
The thing is, most people who are behind enemy lines don't announce themselves.
Well, they didn't give me a choice because they attacked me first. Remember, Mom said, don't start the trouble. But if it comes to you, you need to handle it.